And so now, to be clear, these recordings I put online on this website, they're for you and for you only. I don't want snippets of what I'm saying, you know, go out on social networks making fun of me. I do say stupid things. I do say things that maybe can be, not politically correct sometimes. Okay, so here's the technology not helping already. This is Face ID, so I need to show my face. Okay, so website is back. So, and in general, the content of this web page, because it has many links to articles, papers, that are protected by copyright, I can put them on this website for educational purposes, but you're not supposed to take those PDFs and send them around to the world, right? So, just a few, and this is what it says in red here. Now, to get to this website, you have to... Can you read? So it's www.lri.fr, which is the last thing as my email address, /tilde MBL. You know the tilde is the little wiggly sign. /fundHCI, like fundamentals of HCI. So on this website, I put all the slides that I'm presenting. In fact, I have the handouts for today's slides. I'll put the audio files if the recording works. I put also a bunch of links to papers, to videos, to other resources. And I am not asking you to read and look at all of them because I tried to put a lot of it. And you could spend your too much time on it. But if you're interested in a particular topic, sometimes some of it is used by the TAs. So speaking of the TAs, so in your schedule, the class is the lecture is scheduled on Wednesday mornings, 9:30 to 12:30, and the TAs are scheduled on Thursday afternoon from 1 p.m. to 3. Because some of you have to rush at the other end of campus for French class, right? Mm-hmm. Yes. and so, however, what we're going to do this year is to mix and match the lectures and TAs. So on most weeks, on Wednesday mornings, I'll do an hour and a half in teaching, and there'll be an hour and a half in TA, and same thing on Thursday. I'm saying on most weeks because I have scheduling constraints, and it's not going to work every week. Now, this Wednesday morning, it's even more special because the second part of the lecture is going to be given by Wendy Mackay here. So Wendy and I are, I think we can say we're the co-founder of this master's program.
That's right.
Yes. And so you'll be teaching what is called the boot camp that I'm sure you heard about in the... welcome session. Yes, you were at the welcome session on Friday? Yes. And so you know, the boot camp is this 1 week intensive course on designing of interactive systems. But for this to work, she needs you to do some work in advance. So she's going to use the last part of this session today to tell you what this is all about. You want to say anything else? Introduce yourself.
No, I think you'll take a break, but come back from the break so we have enough time to really figure out what this is. Because if you do this exercise, the first exercise really well, then you'll survive your 4 days of intensive stuff. And if you don't do it well, you will not be happy. So this is to help you succeed. I will leave you to this, and I'll be back after the break.
Okay.
Okay.
See you then. So here I've put the prospective schedule. There is 1 week, there's no class nor TAs, and it's not the normal week in the rest of the calendar, but I will be going to a conference that week, so we've swapped the week with that week. And there may be other changes. I happen to be involved in a number of administrative responsibilities, and sometime, you know, if the president of the university tell me there's a meeting you have to go to, I'm sorry, but sometimes I have to go. So, but we'll make it work with swapping with TA sessions. Do you have any question about the overall organization? No? I'm surprised. Usually there's one question. Okay, so you don't want to know how you'll be graded. That's fine. Too late. I won't tell you. Oh, you want to know. So the way we grade this course is in the TA sessions, you'll have some assignments. And you'll be graded on those assignments. That's part of the grade. The other part of the grade is an exam that you take at the very last week. So it's 1 week after week 7 here. At some point along the way, I will put the archive of all the exams I've given on previous years so you can get a sense of what it's like. So it's that simple. Okay? So now we're going to switch to the slides. Now, of course, it's not doing what I want. Yeah. Let's start at the beginning. It'll be better. There's another thing I want to do is I want to know you a little bit better. So we have students from different programs here. So we have Master 1 students in the HCID program from EIT. So who are you? Can you raise your hands? Okay, there's a good chunk. So usually I try to go around the room and get to know you one by one, but that would take the rest of the morning. So I see people coming from different parts of the world. Then we have people from the what we call the M2 HCI or M2 interaction. Yes? Okay. Then we have the M1 international program. Yes, the back row. You made it all the way from Ivry, right? Good. Then we have one person from a new degree we're starting this year, which is a degree of a Fab Lab Manager. So if you're interested in digital fabrication and you take the class there, you'll probably see... I don't remember your first name. I'm sorry?
Rémi.
And do we have other... people from Central Supélec or Telecom or somewhere else? No? Okay. How many people here have were in Paris Sud last year? Okay. So the other ones, you should look at these people because they can tell you about, you know, how to find your way around this moving campus, because I think you've noticed it's a little bit under construction. I really don't have the time. I would really love to go around the room and know a little bit more about your background. But so I want this class to be interactive, so I encourage you to interrupt me to ask questions. And I will ask you questions and wait until, you know, you react. The other thing is this, for me, this introduction class is trying to open your eyes or to give you new eyes on things. You all use interactive technology. I'm assuming you all have a laptop and a smartphone, more or less, yes? Right. So, like several billion people at this point, all every day pretty much, you poke at screens, at keyboards, and things. So, you probably think you know interaction and user interfaces. And if you picked this specialty, you know, probably it's because you have an interest in that. Am I correct? Yes. Now, what I want to try to do, because what I've observed over the years, is that students are more and more shaped by the fact that they've been using computers for longer and longer. I started here, you won't believe this, in 1984, 83 even. So I started doing HCI before you were born, I assume. Now, at the time, it was a different thing. It was, you know, everything was to be invented, in a sense. Now we have the opposite thing. You know, you are millennials. You grew up with computers. So it's much harder for you than it was for us to challenge things, because you think that, well, this is the way it is. This is the way it works. We have Windows. We have, you know, we tap, we swipe, we etc. And so what I want to show you is that, yeah, this is one form of interaction. It's very popular. It works. But you are the people who can take this to the next level, right? But to be able to take this to the next level or to invent new forms of interaction, you need to be able to challenge the existing and to think different, to take a motto from a big company, Apple, for those who don't know. So in order to think different, you need to be able to be to look at things differently. And so part of what I'm trying to do in this intro class is make you look at things differently and give you the tools to look at things differently. So this is pretty much what we'll be covering. I may change my mind along the way on a few things. Today it's an introduction to the introduction, if I may say so. Next week we'll talk about the history of interaction, because I think if you don't know the history, you cannot invent the future. We'll talk also about what I call psychology 101. Human-computer interaction is about humans as well as computers, which leads me to my first question. Who here has a background in computer science? Okay. That's going to be tough for you, because you have to, you know, step out of the computer. And who has a background in other disciplines? Yeah, raise your hands. Okay, that's a lot. That's great. And I see a lot of people, if I remember well, from the HCID program, and that's part of what we do in our recruiting process. So can I sample a few people to so they tell us what's their background?
I'm a designer, visual information designer.
Visual information designer, yes. Good. We need you. Someone else? I saw some hands here. Yes?
I have a bachelor's in human computer interaction.
You have a bachelor's in HCI?
Yep.
Wow, impressive. You don't have anything to learn. So where from?
I'm from the University of Oslo.
Oslo? Norway. Yes. I know Oslo is in Norway. okay, I didn't know there were bachelor's in HCI. Yeah, that's fascinating. Yes?
I did industrial engineering and human factors engineering.
Human factors engineering, and where?
Where?
Yeah.
Wisconsin, U.S.
Oh, U.S.
Yeah.
Oh, Americans are now coming to France.
Yeah.
okay, so human factors, it's an interesting. Human factors and ergonomics and HCI, they have this long love-hate relationship. So we'll get to this. Someone was, yeah? Okay, so at the bachelor's level?
Yeah.
Where?
In Trento, University of Trento.
Oh, Trento. Okay. Yeah, so cognitive science is the human side of things. So, welcome. Anybody else wants to say something? Yes?
I have a background of industrial design.
Industrial design.
And I work as a UX designer in a car company for 2 years.
Yes?
Yeah, so I kind of have a background of specializing in the automobile industry. Yeah.
Okay, yeah. And now cars are going to become autonomous, so, you know,
yeah,
it won't be, yeah, we won't have to do anything anymore, so the problem is solved, right?
Yeah, but there's no more chance, you know, for the interaction part in the car.
Yes, yeah, we can be able to, you know, Skype in the car and all that. And I think autonomous cars is an interesting challenge for HCI, so we'll probably use that as an example on several applications. I'm checking this is still recording, so we're in good shape. So Psychology 101, I don't have a background in psychology. Wendy has. but I want to, you know, give you the basics of the basics of human psychology that is relevant to HCI. We'll talk about graphical interaction, which is the stuff you use every day and you think you know, but we'll try to take a little bit of a different look at it. What we call post-WIMP interaction, the WIMP thing will explain itself along the way, which are the things you probably know less about. Very little about engineering of interactive systems, how systems are built, and then conceptual design, which is how you create a design for an interactive systems, and try to give you an overview of theories and models of interaction. The reason for this is because a number of you will continue, hopefully, into research and maybe academia, maybe in a PhD. A number of you will continue in industry. So we're trying to cater to, you know, both, and maybe a number of you don't know yet. So we try to give you things that is relevant to do research in HCI, but also to become a practitioner. So what is human-computer interaction? Why do we call these things HCI or HCI-D? What is human-computer interaction? Now, for many, many years, in France in particular, the field was known more as user interfaces. And I, among others, have been fighting, so we talk about interaction, not interfaces. In fact, I've written a paper called Designing Interaction, Not Interfaces. And here's why. Human-computer interaction. So we have humans. Here's a human. Human beings have certain capabilities. We have capabilities for action. I can act on things with my body, with my hands, with my voice. We have capabilities for perception of the outside world. I can see, I can hear, I can touch. We have cognitive capabilities. We can think, we can plan action, we can make decisions, etc. And on the other side, we have computers. And computers have their own capabilities. Now, it's tempting to equate them or to relate them to each other. Computers have capabilities for storing stuff. They have capabilities for input and output. I can type on keyboards. I can see what's on the screen. I can hear the noises it makes. It has capabilities for computation. They can calculate things. And of course, there is a very strong temptation to compare these capabilities, to say, you know, the computer is making decisions. We talk a lot about AI. Have you heard about AI these days a little bit? Yes? We talk a lot about AI, artificial intelligence, and it's all about the computer is now better than the humans at doing this and that and the other thing, driving a car, detecting a disease in a medical image. There is a temptation to say that, you know, the computer can have the same types of capabilities as humans. And a lot of the program of AI has been to try to do this. And that's fine in a way, but personally I find this is limiting. I mean, if you were to create the perfect robot that, you know, you've seen these TV series, right, where you have these Android robots that are have the shape and behavior of humans. Personally, I find that very boring. I don't see the point. I mean, we have enough human beings on Earth, right? I don't see why we need to create artificial ones. That's my take. I accept the fact that you can have a different opinion. But I think there's another perspective, which is how can computers make us better at what we do? So can we exploit the capabilities of computers for things that humans cannot do? Right? And I think the role of human-computer interaction is to create what in our group we call partnerships. A partnership, when two people work together, it's usually more productive if they have complementary skills. You know, in this room, we have computer scientists who know to program stuff. We have designers who know how to design stuff. You'll get a better system if you put a designer and a programmer or a developer working together than if you take, you know, two designers or two developers. And I think it's exactly the same thing with computers. We can get very interesting new things if we exploit the capabilities of computers of doing things that humans are not good at. And that's a good thing because computers are very good at things that humans are terrible at, like calculating things. Computers are pretty bad at doing things that humans are very good at, such as making decisions, taking into account the multiplicity of factors. So we have humans, we have computers, and so what I call interaction, what we should call interaction, sometimes people tend to reduce the term, but for me the interaction is the phenomenon that happens when you put a human being in front of a computer. Stuff happens. They interact. They can decide to not interact, but that's a form of interaction. You know, if I ask you what time it is and you don't respond, you have interacted in a way by not doing anything. But of course, it's more interesting if people do interact. So the interaction is the phenomenon that occurs when people use computers. And the field of human-computer interaction is about controlling this phenomenon. And I mean controlling here in a psychology way, in behavioral psychology, if you wish, where we try some specific qualities of this interaction. We try to achieve some specific qualities of this interaction. So we try to make the interaction more, I don't know, intuitive. I don't know, you have other ideas of qualities we expect from interaction? Engaging, yes? Yeah?
Easier, faster,
more efficient. And so if we want to control this phenomenon, well, we can do two kinds of things. We can try to act on the human side. I don't know. I'm not very much into hacking into the human brain, but there's ways to actually change human behavior without going into the brain. But of course, the main way we have to control this interaction is to change what the computer is doing and how we interact with that computer. And so it's by building what we call typically user interfaces, a word I don't like because the user interface always look like the coat of paint that you put, you know, at the end, or the packaging on the box. I prefer to talk about interactive systems, because if you want those qualities of interaction, if you want interaction to be more efficient, to be more pleasurable, more engaging, more whatever, you need to think globally about this interactive systems. It's not just by adding a button there or changing the color of the background of the screen that you're going to, I mean, it's important elements as well, but to attain these qualities, you really need to rethink sometimes the entire system all the way down to sometimes the operating system. To take one example, we all have one of those in our pockets. Now, the computing power of a smartphone today is larger than all the computing power that was used to put a man on the moon 50 years ago. So we have this amazing machine in our pockets. Now, I can tell you that there are differences still between different brands, different operating systems in terms of interaction. When the iPhone first came out, one thing that made it way more responsive than any of the devices that had been done before was that the operating system was redesigned so that as soon as your finger approaches the screen, the operating system stopped doing anything else. It would stop doing networking, doing background computation, so that all the computing power, which in the first iPhone was a fraction of this, was dedicated to interaction. And that's how you got this smooth scrolling that gave you the impression that you're really pushing this page on your screen. Now, this is interface design. This is the type of qualities you want to obtain. And to do this, sometimes you have to redesign and to rebuild things from the ground up. And that's why I use the term interactive systems rather than just user interface. Now, of course, this picture is very simplistic. This interaction does not happen in the void. It happens in a certain environment, in a physical environment. If you are sitting in a class, you can have a laptop that you put on the table. But you know, if you're in the bus, you want a mobile device. But there's also the social environment, the organizational environment, in a company, the way people work together and the types of tools they need to use, even a cultural environment. So in fact, interaction in the real world is what we call situated. And Wendy and I run another class that you guys won't get to take, unfortunately, that we call Fundamentals of Situated Interaction, which is sort of the follow-up to this class. Because interaction involves people and computers, but it also involves more people, more than one person. I mean, today, most of the things we do involve groups of people. And I'm not just talking about social networks, but you know, a lot of the projects you're going to do are going to be group projects. Whether you work in a company or in research, everything we do involves documents that we share, things we build together. So it's not just one person, one computer. It's multiple people. Of course, it's multiple computers as well. My icons are a little bit outdated here. There's a CD player. Can you believe this? But you get the picture. Everybody has 2, 3, 4 computers. And we also interact with other things than computers. So we interact with what I call artifacts, physical objects, paper. I mean, I see a lot of you taking notes on paper. In fact, it's interesting. I think it's down from last year, the use of... last year, I had a bunch of people taking notes on their laptops. And you know what? You should write instead of type. Because studies have shown that when you write things by hand, you sort of integrate them better. Because you have to sort of process and distill them rather than frantically typing what the teacher is trying to say. But my point is that we interact with physical artifacts. And still today, the junction between the physical and the digital is very clumsy. I've been starting to use an iPad. I still prefer taking notes on paper, even though you know there's a very nice note-taking app on there. But it's not the same thing. So a lot of the things that, in fact, we talk about in this program in general is ways to better integrate the digital and the physical. And of course, this happens in environment. Over the past, I would say, 10 years, mobility has become a major change where we can use computers on the go very much more so than 10 years ago. But it affects everything we do. Now, here's the first maybe challenging idea for some of you, especially in a background in computer science. I think the way we've been engineering computers for the past, what? When did computers start, by the way? Does anybody know?
The most primitive?
50s. Yes, primitive. 50s, 60s. 50s, 60s. Yeah. Well, it's actually the late 40s, but okay. So we're talking 70, 80 years ago, right? I think the way we've been building computers all along has been wrong in terms of supporting interaction. Because when you learn about computing, you learn about what I call algorithmic systems. A lot of the classes to introduce computer science are about computer science is about algorithms. You know, if you don't know how to program Quicksort, you're not a computer scientist. Now, an algorithm, the way you learn algorithms is it's a recipe that, you know, reads input. So you have to sort an array of numbers. So I enter the numbers. Then the thing is doing processing. And that happens in this black box. We don't know how. And then it spits out some results. And then it's done. Now, this is not what interaction is about. There's no interaction there. I mean, interaction means the reciprocal action on one thing on another thing. In our case, between the user and the computer, or user and the running program. Here, I enter things at the beginning, it spits out things at the end, and then it's done. So there is a paper that you should really read, and I think the teaching assistants will have it, will have you read it, called Interaction is More Powerful Than Algorithms. This is a paper that changed my life. Because when I started as a PhD student, in fact, in the same lab I'm still in today, I started doing HCI without knowing HCI existed. I was in a group doing software engineering, and they were doing the theoretical side of it, but they were also doing the practical side of building tools for software engineers. And these tools were interactive. But I was always seen, and I was seen myself, as the guy who's doing the coat of paint at the end to make the thing, you know, pretty. And, you know, I was doing lots of demos because there was something to see, whereas a lot of the other work that was done in the lab was mostly theoretical and, you know, looking at a black box where you enter things and it spits things out was not very interesting. So for many years, I thought, well, you know, I'm interested in this stuff. I'm not sure why, but I'm really drawn to this interaction stuff. But it's not at the top of the food chain in computer science. And then I read this article by Peter Wegner, who is a very respected researcher in theoretical computer science. And of course, the title caught my eye, Interaction is More Powerful Than Algorithms. And I realized that he was explaining that if you make things interactive, they are more powerful, but even in a theoretical way. And this article actually has been challenged by other people. But I still think it stands, that through interaction you can do things that that are not possible through simple algorithmic systems. So what is an interactive system then? So the way I describe it is that it's a computer system that holds a state, so it has internal, I will call it objects, but it doesn't have to be done with an object-oriented language or anything, but it has a state. You know, when you log into a system, there are documents in there, or there's a database, or just stuff that is there, very much like in the physical world, there are, you know, chairs and tables in this room. And then this internal state that you don't get to see because it's bits and atoms on hard drives and things, it creates a perceivable representation, something you can, in general, at least see, but it can be perceivable through other means, through your ears, through touch, but again, mostly visually. And of course, it maintains the consistency. If the internal state changes, you want the visual state to reflect that. Now, already we're not talking algorithms here. I mean, there are algorithms to make this work, but the conceptual model of this is I want to think of when I see the little icon on the screen, it is the file. And even if I know it's not, if I don't buy this identity, I'm not going to be able to use the system efficiently. And the last point, and probably the most important, is that when the system receives input, tapping, touching, talking, whatever, it will affect the internal state and therefore be reflected in the output. And here, there is no notion of starting and ending. An interactive system conceptually never stops. In fact, again, you grew up in a world where it was probably normal that, you know, when you turn your computer on, you get it in the same state that you left it when you shut it down. It didn't used to be the case. It used to be the case that every time you start the computer, you start from scratch. You had to reopen your Windows, your application, your documents, your this and your that. So we've spent amazing amounts of energy, of computational energy, to make it work like this, because the basic blocks we have in operating systems, in file systems, in all the layers of software on top of which we build interactive systems, all of these things are working in a sense against us, against this model of an interactive system. And part of the reason it's so hard and sometimes frustrating to build interactive systems is because we have this clash between the culture of algorithms and the culture, I would say, of interaction. So, three important properties of interactive systems. So, in this slide, U means user, S means system. So, it has to be reactive. You know, I expect the system to react when I do something to it. So, I provide an input to the system, and the system must process it immediately and generate output to the user. Even if this output is in the form or I got it, it's going to take some time, but I'm on it, rather than, you know, wait until it's done processing and giving me the feedback. Now, this all relates to stuff I will talk about in the Psychology 101 class about how human function, you know. But we expect that if I push an object, it falls. So action, reaction. And so we want to build on these capabilities that we have to create interactive systems that, I don't want to say mimic the real world, but exploit our the way we interact with the real world. So reactive. Second, has to be open. The system should not make too many assumptions about the dependencies between what it's giving me and what I'm going to do next. Now, this is arguable, and with this whole slew of AI, I think a lot of people would challenge that. But the fact of the matter is people like systems to be predictable, right? If I'm pushing an object off the table and it falls, it falls. If it's this bottle, it's not going to break. If it's a glass, it's going to break. Okay, well, I learned to be more careful when I manipulate glass than plastic, right? Now, imagine we're in a world where, you know, if something falls and may break, it suddenly reacts differently, it would be a very different world. I mean, maybe you think it would be better. I'm not so sure, because it would be very difficult to predict what happens when I do anything. So there is a very interesting fine line here to walk between predictability, which may be creating more risks, and smart systems that try to second guess what you do. I'm sure you all use smart keyboards that do autocorrection. Yes? So how do you like these things? No, I don't know. Okay? Any fan? Yes. Okay. So why do you like it?
Because I'm dyslexic and I usually write all my words wrong.
Okay. And you've never had any...
Oh, yeah, I hate it at some points, but, you know, it's mostly useful, at least when writing, not my first language.
Oh, yeah. So for you, the pluses are over the minuses. And so people who don't like it, so what's... Okay, and so you see, so this is exactly what I'm talking about, is when the system makes assumptions about future input, so it's trying to help you in a sense, it's very nice when it does the right thing, and it's very frustrating when it doesn't. And so which one outweighs the other depends on the particular person, and the particular things you're doing, et cetera, et cetera. But I think in general, what open here means is that the system must be ready for anything at any time and should not force the user to do things in a certain way. So a lot of systems today, they force you to behave in a certain way. Something I hate, for example, in many systems, you create a new document. You want to save the document so you don't lose it. And I know these days it's usually done automatically. But until even a few years ago, you know, until you had saved your document, if your computer crashes, you would lose it, right? So you learn to save the document when you first create it. Now, when I save the document, I'm asked to give it a name. And it's like, I don't know yet the name, or I don't want to bother about the name. I just want to be sure I'm not going to lose the document, right? So this is called, we'll talk about it in later class, premature commitment. The system is forcing me to do something in order to continue its work, something that I don't want to do now. And in general, you should not do that. There may be cases where, for, I don't know, safety-critical systems, it makes sense. But in general, if you can avoid it, you should. And every time you have this kind of situation, it's because that made the job of the programmer easier rather than thinking of the user experience. And the last point, and not the least, is that this creates an asymmetry. I want the system to react immediately when I do something. I don't want to have to react immediately when the system does something. And more we have these things that, you know, ring at us and do this and do that. And I think, you know, users and computers are different. I expect the users to be at my beck and call. I don't want to be the slave to the computer. And similarly, even though the system should not have particular expectations about what the user is going to do next, the user likes to know, and this is what I was talking about, likes to know the dependencies between what I'm going to input and the output that's going to come out. I want to be able to anticipate the system behavior. So all of these properties are, I think, specific of interactive systems. That they're not really relevant to algorithmic systems. Of course, to make this happen, you have to implement algorithms. But my point here is that we can translate some of the properties that we want to have at the interaction level into this kind of properties of the interactive system itself. And so a lot of the things that you learn about user experience design and about programming user interfaces sort of can be framed in that, in terms of these properties. And this leads me to one of the another one of the things we battle in our research group. You hear a lot. Have you heard this expression, "human in the loop"? No. Yeah. Well, it's not used in sort of the mass media, but it's used a lot in industry. So we've created these algorithmic systems. And then we realized, oh crap, there are things they cannot do. Or, you know, here we need user human input to do something the computer doesn't do well enough yet. And so we need to put the human in the loop. And every time I hear that expression now, I think of this picture. You know this movie, right?
Yes.
Yes. I feel like the human in the loop is putting me in a situation when I am slave to the machine, when I'm being asked to do something because the machine cannot do it or the programmers were too lazy to make it do it. So it's a system-centric view. It seems like, okay, I have this problem, I need to solve this problem, so I'm going to put the human because I need the human to provide input to the algorithm for the algorithm to improve. This is a lot of stuff that happens these days. You know, the reason why there's all these issues about capturing personal data and data in general is to improve computers. Now, usually this is done to improve what I call operational tasks, where the user is able to do things that a computer cannot yet do. And I don't think that's the right way to... And so you hear a lot of this in safety critical system. Or we're going to leave a pilot in the cockpit because, you know, if something goes wrong, the pilot will take care of it. Autonomous cars, you know, we're still probably going to have a steering wheel for a long time in cars because if we ever manage to make fully autonomous cars, in the meantime, we have semi-autonomous cars. Now, think a minute of what this means. How many of you have a driver's license? Ooh, impressive. I have two sons. None of them are even interested in getting a driver's license. And they're 25. I don't get it. Anyway, so, you know, driving, right? It takes, you know, time to learn to drive and to master the skill. And then, I don't know how long you've been driving and if you drive very much, but then it becomes kind of second nature. Now, imagine a world where we have these semi-autonomous cars, where most of the time, you don't have to do anything, right? So you're sitting behind the wheel, but you chat with a person next to you, you listen to music, you call someone on the phone, you watch a DVD, etc. And then suddenly the car says, oh, I can't handle this. And then you have a split second to correct the situation. So, what's happened is, first, you have been de-skilled. You've learned to not have to drive. So whatever driving skill you had, you know, if you don't practice it, you lose it. And then in a split second, you have to become suddenly an expert driver. Because if the car cannot handle it, it has to be pretty bad, right? So to me, that's what human in the loop means. It's how, you know, we put the human as a diffuse in the system, have someone to blame, and that's why it's a word that's often used in safety critical systems. And this is tragic, but you look at recent accidents in airplanes. You've heard the saga of the 737 Max from Boeing. But there was also the Air France flight of Brazil. You know, in a sense, they tried to blame the pilots, but the pilots had to make decisions with inaccurate information from the computer systems, which is why the plane was in trouble in the first place, and an environment where it was constantly buzzing at them because the one thing they were doing that could have saved the plane was triggering more alarms than if they were doing the wrong thing. And so I think we have to rethink these systems. I mean, as computers are going to be more and more in every aspect of our lives and in safety-critical systems like cars and planes, we can't think in this human-in-the-loop way. So what we talk about in our group is computer-in-the-loop. We want to put the human in the center and design the system around it. So instead of a system-centric view, it's a human-centric view, where the computer must be adapted to the capabilities of the user. I use this image, which is from a system developed at IRCAM. IRCAM is a lab in Paris that works on music and well, I'm going to say music and computers to make it short, but it's more than that. And so they've created this violin. So you have to be a violinist to be able to play it, but there is a sensor here that has an actuator on the violin that can change the way the violin sounds. And so as you, in a sense, you're creating a new instrument because you can control how the way you play affects the way the system changes the way the violin resonates and changes the sound of the violin. So to me, this illustrates this notion of partnership where each one complements the other, but based on human skills, not based on the constraints of the system. And so in our group, we work a lot on creative tasks, creative professionals, musicians, choreographers, but also scientists, because scientists are creative as well, to see how the computer can extend or augment our capabilities and not treat us as slave to the machine who take the blame when the machine goes wrong. Okay, so this is a diagram I will refer to quite regularly. This is what I call the conceptual model of an interactive system. It's sort of a high-level model of how an interactive system works. Hello? Yeah? No? I don't see you. It's essentially a way to think of the various building blocks in an interactive system. The idea is that you have to provide input to the system, so you provide input in the forms of commands. And by commands, it can be something you type on the command line, it can be things you click on the screens, it can be a voice command, and maybe other forms of input. And as you enter this command, it will give you some feedback. It's silly, but as you type on the keyboard, you expect the characters to appear one by one, right? That's the least it can do. When you click on the screen or even moving the cursor, you expect the little arrow to move. So this is what I call feedback while you are specifying the command. And then you're done with the command. Now, there are situations where this segmentation of commands is not as obvious as it seems, for example, in gesture-based interaction. But let's say you are able to identify a command, then this command is turned into what I call operations that affect those internal objects, the internal state I was talking about earlier. So it's going to do something in there, in your database, in your whatever. And of course, what you want to know is the result of that operation. And so that's what I call the response. The system changes its perceivable state so you can see what happened. And sometimes nothing happens, but again, the fact that nothing happens is in itself a sign. So as I am, for example, dragging an icon towards the trash can, I have feedback because I see the little icon following my movement. Then I dump it into the trash can, so there something happens, saying, well, let's delete this file or put it in a temporary trash. And then I get some response. I don't know, on the early Macs, the trash was getting bigger. It's like you felt like, you know, you put it somewhere. These days, I don't think there is a very good response for this interaction. Now, this is very useful because it helps you figure out, how to, and we'll see a method to identify these objects, these operations, and then the interactions to control these. And next time, I'll talk a little bit about the notion of mental model, but it's the model you have in your head of how the system works. Whenever you act in the world, you have a mental model. When you came here this morning, you had a mental model of how you would go to take a train and then the bus and then walk, etc. And if the reality doesn't match your mental model, then you have to correct things or solve the problem. With computers, you make a mental model of how things should work. And if they don't work the way you think they should, that's where you get into trouble, right? And so the ultimate goal of a good designer of an interactive system is to create conceptual models that match the mental model of the majority of the users, because we each have, of course, different ones. So we'll get back to this in time. Now, beware. As I said at the beginning, we all use interactive systems. We all think we know how to improve them. But not everyone is a designer or an HCI researcher. This is particularly important because the measure of success, a good interactive system, is something that becomes invisible, or some people say transparent. You know, if it works well, you don't notice it. And so as a good designer, you're happy if nobody mentions the work you did, which is kind of frustrating. And this is because people don't realize that making things simple, and by simple, I mean transparent, really, making things simple is difficult. Right? Creating an interface where you're going to have buttons everywhere for every function you can think of, that's very easy. Right? Everybody can do that. Deciding what to take out of an interface is very hard. I mean, Apple is famous for, usually having in their first version of software fewer things that you really want. But, they want to make sure when they add something that it needs to be there and it's properly designed. And so simplicity is difficult. The other thing is we are extremely, extremely adaptable beings. That's a very good thing. I think it got us where we are. For us, it's also, I don't want to say a bad thing, but sometimes a weakness, because you get into habits that are very hard to change. And so if you get used to an interactive system that has a poor design, you probably, once you've gotten used to it, prefer to keep it than to change for a new one that will make you more efficient. Because for a period of time, you'll probably be less efficient. So there's this kind of hurdle. And as computers are used by more and more people who are don't have to be, technical, things that have been widely disseminated then becomes very, very hard to change. There's a good example, and I could do an entire class on the keyboard, Why do we have the layout of the keyboard that we have? It's not the optimal one, but good luck if you want to change it. So HCI is a multidisciplinary domain, and we need to have more designers and HCI researchers.
Don't mind me.
No, I don't mind you. It's just hard because I'm getting to your slides here. So. So this is slides I borrowed from Wendy about the multidisciplinary aspect of our field. So HCI, or the design of interactive systems, is here in the middle. And this is why I was asking in the beginning where you guys are what kind of background you have, because of course we need the engineering and technical backgrounds in computer engineering, but also electrical engineering, mechanical engineering. Every year I say I'm going to fix that typo. optics, you name it. I mean, especially now that we have all these devices in different shapes and forms. So this is very important. There's also the design side that is important. So product design, visual design, typography, etc., or even architecture, as we think of, room and building scale interfaces. And there's also all the natural sciences, starting with psychology, but also sociology, because everything we do, as I say, tends to involve groups of people, and things like anthropology or physiology for more specific aspects. Now, nobody can be knowledgeable in all of these things at once. So we always argue that, companies who develop interactive systems should somehow gather a mix of skills to design interactive systems. Unfortunately, it's not often the case, but you really need these three legs: engineering, design, natural sciences. And when it comes to doing research in this field, it's also important to combine the natural science side of things with the more technical and with the design. Now, design is not seen as a scientific discipline, which is problematic to create multidisciplinary teams in academia. But there's another issue. If you look at a discipline like psychology, well, human psychology, so you study human behavior, right? So typically, this is an area where you have theories about human behavior. In the 60s and 70s, behaviorism was a big thing. Wendy can tell you a lot about it. She trained chimps to talk, so... No, to use language. So we're trying to understand, language. So you have theory, and then you design experiments to test this theory, and usually you have to refine your theory to run new experiments and refine your knowledge and your understanding of things. So you go back and forth between theory and the real world. Now, in other fields, you start more from observations. So if you look at anthropology, you go out there in the jungle and you observe a tribe, or you go to another jungle in the Silicon Valley and observe another type of tribe. And based on this observation, we create what they tend to call frameworks rather than models, but sort of theories about things that you've observed, the rituals they have or whatever. And then you go back to make more observation, and you go back and forth. Now, this is the normal flow of natural science. You observe the natural world, you make theories about it, and you go back and forth to test them and refine them. But we are in a technological field where there is another line here, which is that we're not just observing the physical world, we're also building things. We are modifying the world. We are adding what I call artifacts. So we create new things. And so now you want to use theories from human behavior, for example, to inform the design of these new things. You want to also observe work practices, how people do things today, to see how the computer could help them make it better, in order to design, simulate, to do simulations, prototypes, etc., so that then you can both refine your knowledge of how people interact with this type of systems and do evaluations and further observations to see how people use these new systems. So we have this constant back and forth, and when we do research in our group, we do all these things. And part of the methods that Wendy will teach in the bootcamp, among other things, have to do with how to make this work, in a sense. So it's a very rich, the message here is that it's a very rich and complex area. And it's made complex by the fact that, we have few quantitative theories about human behavior, or generative theories, which means it's not like in physics where you have an equation, you have a law that says, it takes that much time for this thing to fall off the table, so I can do the math and find, the optimal height of the table, or I don't know. There are very few laws that allows us to, in a sense, mechanically derive a design for a particular problem in HCI. And the other thing, and maybe it's linked to that, it has a chaotic aspect. By that I mean, chaotic systems are systems where a very small change can have a big effect. Have you heard of the butterfly effect? Mm-hmm. I have a butterfly flying away. Butterfly effect, where a butterfly flaps its wings in the Pacific and it creates a tornado in the other end of the world. Never heard of that?
Yeah, sure.
Yes, okay. yeah, please give me feedback, you know, interaction. Sorry?
That's the Bradbury story.
The Bradbury story, yes. So, but it's something in design. I mean, you can make very small changes in the system that will radically change the way people interact with it. It can be in the timing. One of my favorite examples is a 1 pixel difference between older versions of Windows and Mac OS. So on the Mac, you have a menu bar at the top. So if you want to go to a menu at the top, you move your cursor, and it's going to bang against the top of the window. And then you click, you have the menu, you click the menu. Now on Windows, well, the menu bar is inside the window, right? Now a lot of people maximize that window, which essentially puts the menu bar at the top, like on the Mac. Unfortunately, they had left 1 pixel border between the top of the menu bar and the top of the screen. So if you put your cursor at the top and you click, you're clicking on this 1 pixel and nothing happens. 1 pixel. 1 pixel, twice the time. And that's one of the few things you can quantify with something called Fitts' law that we'll talk about. But it made every click in the menu twice as long. So it's very hard to anticipate, you know, the effects of some decisions. And that's why we need to go for what we call an iterative design cycle. We try things, we test them, we see what works, what doesn't, we improve, we redesign, we restart. In fact, in Wendy's class, you will do a design and a redesign, because the redesign is the hard part, and the interesting one as well. Okay, and of course I'm behind schedule. So that's the last slide, I think, of this intro to the intro. In this class, I will mostly talk about an approach that we call computer as tool or first-person interfaces. It's in the spirit that we want to create tools that augment human capabilities, what Steve Jobs was calling the bicycle for the mind. Now, this is one, so there's this big word called interaction paradigm. It's the general conception you have of interaction. So you can think of the computer as a tool that, you know, allows me to do things that I would not be able to do without the tool. The second approach is more the AI-driven approach of the computer as a partner, a computer that has capabilities that are similar to that of humans, so I can speak to it and it can talk to me and I can negotiate things, delegate tasks. So this is a lot of the AI-based approach. Personally, I think it would be good to combine these things. There's a third one that I talk about in the other class I teach on groupware and collaborative interaction, which is the computer as a medium. The computer as a way to help people to communicate with other people. So that covers email and Skype and social media and shared documents and a lot of the things we do. So in this class, I will be focusing on this because there's not time for everything, and that's the thing I know a few things about anyway. Okay, so this was the intro to the intro of the intro. Do you have any questions when I figure out how to switch to the next slides? Yes, questions? Okay, let's move on then. Now this one has videos, so. We'll see how it works. Okay, so now we have this sort of a bird's eye view of the topic. Now I want to be a little bit more practical, talking about interaction styles. The idea here is to do a taxonomy, quick taxonomy of how we interact with computers. in previous years, I was doing this part after the historical part, which is why there are this weird images at the bottom. I decided to change this year. I'll do the history part next week. We'll see how it works. So interaction styles. Now, it took a long time before computers became actually interactive. And, you know, what does it mean to be interactive? You know, in the early days, you had to put the zeros and ones on big boards. That was interaction, but not very interesting. So here I'm starting around the time where you could interact with the computer in real time. That didn't involve lots of steps. So the early, I would say, interactive systems were conversational systems that use a command language. And that still exists to this day. How many of you are familiar with the terminal on your laptop? Yeah. How many people hate the terminal or don't like the terminal? Yeah, don't be shy. Okay, now here the idea is to have to use the analogy of language, although it's a computer language, so it doesn't have all the subtlety and flexibility of human language, and it's the idea of the dialogue, that, you know, I tell the system to do something by typing words and sentences, and then it's the computer's turn to interpret what I typed and to react to it, give me an answer, and then it's my turn, and then I do something else, and then it's the computer turn. Right? So you all know that. There's not much to say about it. You have to know the language. You have to know the language. And you know that computers are picky with language. So the next step was to say, well, because people are not good at remembering all the syntax and the keywords and all that, we'll give them guidance. And so the systems that I call menus and forms here are things that we use all the time. I mean, you fill out forms on the web all the time, right? A form is not different from typing a kind of sentence where you would specify all the input you've given in each field of the form, right? It's just that the system is giving you guidance because it tells you what to fill out. So here I have a form where I know I need to input my name, my surname, my... This is slides that I did in Denmark. The CPR number is the Denmark version of a social security number. And then here, if you have a sort of very crude menu where if you type one, it's going to do a search, two, a create, and three, a delete. So you don't have to learn the syntax because the system gives you guidance. But it's very much still a dialogue system because the form is there. You have to fill it all out, especially the thing that are in red and says, you know, this is mandatory. You can do it in the order you want, but then at the end, you push the button submit, which is the same as hitting return at the end of the command line, right? So it's just that the system is guiding you. It's still a very crude form of interaction. Now, when the system appeared, they were used to let non-expert users interact with typically databases. So think of a librarian, and the catalog of the library is in a computer system, and someone comes in and asks and wants to find a particular book. And so all these systems were information systems where you had a bunch of what we call nodes, or you can think of it as documents, that are linked together somehow. And so way before we had the web and even the notion, when the notion rather of hypertext was born, that was in the early mid-60s, there was this idea that you had all these things linked together and you needed ways to navigate. So here you have, in a sense, a more reduced form of interaction where the only thing you can do is go from one node to the next and there are links and you follow the links. This is the base of the web today, so you're, of course, familiar with it. Now, the web is a very primitive version of hypertext because you have one kind of link in the web. And I know it's kind of, what does he mean? Why would there be different types of links? Well, you could imagine that a link is going to give you information about the source of a document. Another one can give you a certain type of information, etc. So you can have more richer ways to interconnect information than the single types of links we have on the web. Now, these were combined with what we saw before, because you could have a form to say, I want to find these types of documents, and then you have a collection of documents, and you can navigate among them. Okay, here we are in the 60s and the 70s, and then suddenly, boom, we have a quantum leap in interaction with direct manipulation interfaces. And the idea there is, up until then, you remember this internal state I talked about? There was no really good way to see it. If you're in the terminal, you know you have files everywhere. But every time you want to see your file, you have to type ls, return, see the file. And then you go elsewhere and say ls, etc. So it was very cumbersome to see what was in the computer. With direct manipulation, suddenly you have physical direct actions on these objects or their representations, like icons, like windows, like the documents. So you really, your fingers are touching the bits, so to speak, that represent the information. The principles of direct manipulation were sort of articulated by a famous researcher in the field, Ben Schneiderman, in 1983. Just to get some historical perspective, the Macintosh came out in
84.
Thank you. Yes, January 84. She was there. I was there too. I was not there, but we were around. We saw it. So we've seen the world before the Macintosh. But before the Macintosh, there was another system I'll talk about next year called the Star, which really was the first system to use direct manipulation and computer graphical representations. So the idea is, this is what's behind all the systems you use today, except for the voice things. But everything that's on your screen is based on the principles of direct manipulation. You want continuous representation of the objects of interest so that the things that are there are the things, right? You want physical actions, drag, swipe, pinch, you name it, instead of complex syntax like typing things in the terminal. Now, you can argue that, when you get to keyboard shortcuts or some gesture commands, the syntax may not be as simple as it could be, and there's a trade-off with efficiency as well. But essentially, if you are going to see objects on the screen, you want to be able to touch them. Then you want these operations, you remember operations in my diagram, to be quick, incremental, so I see what's happening as I'm doing it, and reversible, so that if I make a mistake or change my mind, I can easily get back. And I want their effects on the object of interest to be immediately visible. And this is one of the key properties of interactive systems I mentioned before. Now, reversibility, it would be good if everything were reversible. Some things are not, so you always have to do some trade-offs. But if it can be reversible, it should be, because humans learn by doing and learn by failing. So if you know that you can try things and get back, you're more likely to learn by experimenting than if you are scared that anything you do is going to break something. And last is the layered approach to facilitate learning. And the idea here is, you want to both serve the needs of novice users that are not familiar with the system, but you also want experts to be efficient. And so how to make it easy to learn, efficient by expert, and be able to transition is a very difficult problem in itself. So here it's captured in this one sentence, but it's a very challenging thing to do, and most systems these days are not very good at getting you from being a first-time user to an expert user, right? Wendy likes to say that, if you spend as much time learning the piano as you spend time typing on your smartphone, you would be very good at playing the piano. I don't know if you are as expert at using your smartphone. You guys probably, because you're here in this class, but the average user, certainly not. Oh, sorry, yes.
Couldn't direct manipulation include menu, for instance?
Some menu, yes.
You said like menu where separate all the form, but like visual menus could be part of it in a way?
Well, of course, these direct manipulation systems include menus and forms as part. So these things build up rather than really completely replace each other. I wanted to emphasize menus and forms because they're still in this dialogue model. And I think a true direct manipulation system should limit especially the use of forms or dialogue boxes because they're not direct manipulation per se. Sometimes you manipulate through a form rather than, if you want to change the name of a file, to me it makes a significant difference if I can click on the name of the file and edit it there, rather than if I have to click the file, go rename, and then I have a pop-up, and I type the name, and I say okay, and so, but that's all the ambiguity behind the term direct manipulation, and have a whole class that will go into much more depth about this. So the thing is that the Macintosh in particular, but which was the result of earlier work, as I said, typically at the Xerox PARC, led to this era where you could see the things you were manipulating, and the document editing led to this notion of what you see is what you get, is that you could see a document on the screen that looked the same as the printed document, whereas until then you had to use markup languages or other things, so there was this discrepancy between what you see on the screen and what you get on the printer. It also popularized the notion of icons. Icons are very powerful because, icons can represent pretty much anything and everything. And if you have n types of icons, you have n square possibilities of what happens when I drag an icon of one type onto an icon on another type. I mean, not that you probably want to make all these n square possibilities meaningful, but here I have icons that represent folders, that represent maybe people, documents, application, and I can imagine that, if I drag this document onto this person, it would send this person that document by email, maybe as an attachment, or if I take this person to the trash, it means I, taking it away from my list of friends or something. So it has a combinatorial power that gives a lot of possibilities. And I think drag and drop in general is really both one of the key interactions in direct manipulation systems. At the same time, it's underused. At the same time, it's not always obvious to know what you can drag where. How many of you use a Mac? Okay. How many use Windows? Okay. How many use Linux? Okay. How many use none of the above? Okay. So I saw some hands raised multiple times. That's fine. Now, for those of you who use a Mac, when you open a document, you have the title of the document in the... I don't have it in this in this screenshot. But you have the name of the document in the title bar of the window. And next to it, there is a little icon. How many of you know that you can actually long click on that icon and then drag it? Okay. Well, it turns out that it's an icon, and yes, you can drag it like the icons that are in the normal windows, if you wish. But somehow, because it's in the title bar, because it's small, maybe because you have to do a long click, so you have to have the idea of not just clicking on it, but long clicking, very few people discover it. And that's the challenge of interaction, is how do you make things consistent enough so people will learn and use, build on their knowledge, but also discover things serendipitously by sort of chance, by doing something sometimes by mistake and say, oh, this works. I didn't know it did. And so that's one of the challenges of direct manipulation, but also gestural interfaces, and we'll talk about this some more. So this set of techniques around direct manipulation led to what we called WIMP interfaces, windows, icons, menus, and pointing. The idea is that we want to represent things graphically through windows and icons. We want to interact through, the M stands for menus, as we were talking about earlier, but that means all the interactive devices that you have, dialog boxes, text fields, scroll bars, etc. And you use an input device that lets you point at things so you can directly point at the things you manipulate rather than use typically language to refer to it. So this is an example of an old-fashioned WIMP interface, probably around 1998. Now, of course, interacting through a mouse and cursor is a very limited type of interaction compared to what we can do with our hands. Our hands are amazing tools. So there has been, and that dates back to the 70s, that the one of the first touch-based interface can be traced back to 1972 here, of using touch input and more generally gesture input. So there was, before we the smartphones took over, there was this whole era of PDAs. Then before we have the tablets we have today, it was a tablet PC around, I think, 2000. There have been large displays with companies like Smart. And then touch and multi-touch that was popularized by Apple. Apple did not invent multi-touch, it's much, much older, but they managed to redesign an interface so it was adapted to touch, which none of those before had done. On PDAs or on the tablet PC, you had a desktop interface scaled down to a smaller screen with a little stylus where you had to go pick the little tiny buttons and menu items on the screen. It was frustrating to use. So Apple redesigned the entire interface to take into account the fact that, we have what we call fat fingers compared to the resolution of the screen. And moreover, the finger is always on top of the things, is hiding the things you want to tap. So that's two reasons why you're going to be imprecise when you tap at things. So you have to take this into account into the design, and Apple was the first one to solve that. But we tend to think today about gesture-based interaction as touch. First, it's not really touch because there is no haptic feedback. All you touch is a cold, flat piece of glass, whereas if I touch this and I touch this sheet of paper, I can tell the difference with my fingers. So, on the screen, whatever I touch, it will always feel the same. But you can also imagine gestures where you don't have to have physical contact and free hand gestures. Now, you all, of course, all know the Kinect and these devices. Here's a video. First video. I don't know how does it play? Doesn't play.
Oh no!
Oh, it is playing. Okay, so this is Video Place by Myron Kruger, 1983, created this system that had a camera capturing your shadow, really, and then this little bug called Critter was climbing up as much as it could, and the goal was to munch it. And so that was one of the early examples, and you can see here, that, in fact, it was even collaborative because it was someone that had their hands and someone with their full body, and they could play together. So that was one of the early examples of using full body gesture to control interaction. Oh, yeah. Okay, I spare you the the rest. Now, in order to facilitate interaction, we need to build on human skills. We need to build on the fact that people are good at learning and recognizing things. And there is this whole issue in recognition-based interfaces versus recall-based interfaces. If you type things in the terminal, you have to remember the syntax of things, right? So it's a recall-based interface. It relies on the fact that you have to have learned and memorized certain things, the name of the commands, the order of the arguments, et cetera, et cetera. We're not, well, we're, I don't know, are we good or not good at this? Yeah, not so good. Especially because computers require a lot of precision, so and detail. So things like gesture-based interfaces, where you need to draw a gesture to issue a command, they rely on this recall. You need to have learned it and to remember the shape of the gesture. Now, by contrast, a recognition-based interface is going to give you information so you can recognize it and say, oh, this is the menu item I need, right? So a menu system is good because it tells you what's available. So I don't have to remember the name of the command. I have to recognize it. I still have to know what it means and what it's going to do, but at least I don't have to remember the details of it. So a lot of very efficient techniques are based on recall, because when you're an expert, you know all these things, and so you can use shortcuts. You can use a keyboard shortcut, which is based on recall. But for novices, recognition-based is more efficient because they don't know, and they don't sometimes want or have time to learn things. So there's always this tension between these two types of interfaces, and I think a good interface should, in fact, combine the two, especially if we want to leverage the shift from novice to expert. Quickly, because I'm running late. multimodal interaction. So this is the idea of combining voice and pointing. So here is an early example from 1979 called Put That There by Richard. I was looking for the first name, Rick Bolt at MIT. I don't know if we're going to hear the sound, though.
Create a yellow circle there.
This is Krish Mant, a good friend of ours.
Create a cyan triangle there.
And so they created a system where it was using voice combined with gesture. Create
a square there.
This there. So it's look. It's
create
detecting
there.
Where you're pointing at the time where you were saying
that.
There. Put that there. That gave the name of the system.
There. Move that.
Okay, I think you get the picture.
Below that.
If you look, there's something funny at the end. Where the system fails. But you have to watch the other 30 seconds of the video. Other interaction style, virtual reality. So a lot of you will take the class on virtual reality. So it's the idea of immersing the user into a world where everything he sees, perceives, hears, etc., is synthesized by the system, and all of his action and speech is interpreted by the system. So you can be in an artificial world. So this is now become productized with a number of head-mounted displays. And there are a certain number of applications. It's one of these technologies that for many years have been touted as, this is going to be the big thing. I don't know that it will ever be the big thing. It will be a big thing for some applications, maybe games, maybe some applications for training, maybe some things. But it's not going to replace the other devices we use. But it raises some very interesting questions in terms of in the virtual world where you can change all the rules, in a sense, all the laws of physics, you know, how do we build systems that are still easy to use by users? And the last one I want to talk about is here, mixed and augmented reality. So augmented reality was the original name. Then the term was taken over by people coming from virtual reality, so we renamed it mixed reality, and it overlaps with tangible interaction. All in all, the goal is to, unlike virtual reality where you're insulated from the physical world, you want to be immersed in something completely virtual, although there are still walls around, so when you walk around you have to be careful. In mixed and augmented reality, we want to combine the physical world with the virtual world. And there are various ways of doing this. So one of the early things was the digital desk.
I can move my hand above the desk. The camera can see where I'm pointing.
Ooh, it's very...
And the cursor follows my finger. This allows me to use the electronic side of the digital desk, much as an electronic worker.
So this is a projected image of a calculator.
That's why it's the digital desk.
And is tapping on the desk.
An ordinary calculator.
To interact with it.
Eight.
But there's also a camera. So here there's a piece of paper on the side, and there's a camera that can capture something that's been handwritten or printed, like a number, and input it directly in the calculator. So it's combining digital, because it's projecting a digital desktop, letting you interact with it by tapping on the desk, which has a tactile sensor of sorts, but also allow you to use physical paper. To capture the taps, and the camera would track where the finger was when you tapped. But it can also OCR text documents and sort of mix between paper and digital. I'm not going to show the second part of this. You'll see it in the TA. There have been many applications of augmented reality. It also went mobile with the things that led to the Google Glass, which was a massive disaster for Google for various reasons. We have today the HoloLens that is a head-mounted display that allows you to, design a 3D character on your computer and then see it sitting on the side through the glasses. So I just want to finish with a few examples of things that use these different technologies. So this is HoloDesk from Microsoft, where you have this half silvered mirror where you can see your own hands, but you have also these digital objects. Through Kinect, it detects where your hands are, so you can juggle with these objects or manipulate this physical cup and play with the virtual ball here as if it were physical. So it's this idea of combining physical and virtual. The next one. So this was still this was Microsoft again a couple of years later, where they took this room-wise. So they put 5 projectors, Kinects everywhere, and so your living room becomes your game environment. And the system is scanning your room, so it knows where the furniture is, creates a 3D model of this to adapt the game to the physical environment. And so you can have monsters come out of the walls and et cetera. Next example, this is a skin put from Chris Harrison, very hard to see for you maybe. It's a hand. You have a projector on your shoulder projecting the keypad of a telephone on your hand, and so it has a sensor in the arm, so you can tap on the hand and dial on the phone without having a phone. It's called a skin put. Yes?
It's not because they use the Bluetooth technology of the recognition of the room for the nowadays VR headset. So if you start moving the stuff around your room, the VR cannot recognize your room because it does see all the objects.
Yes.
So just tracking yourself. So it's fun that they use this for gaming.
Well, this was a research project. It's just to Sure, but the thing is that they have this scanning system that if you make change, it can rescan, and they gave demos of the system rescanning in real time that was pretty impressive. Going to physical interaction again, this is Inform from Media Lab, where it's a 3D display where on one side you can put your hand, you can put objects, and on the other side they are recreated by this 3D display that has this vertical rods. So you can manipulate things at a distance. You can also have four hands instead of one. You can do all sorts of interesting physical interaction that are mediated and take place at a distance. And the last one is the Zoids, which is from one of the groups here at the lab, which are these little micro robots that can here help you display data physically, so you can take them and put them in another space and they will display something differently. Here they can tell you to not forget your phone when you're leaving your office. And it's using this notion of swarm interfaces to have digital capability in the physical world. And so this is just to show you sort of the progression from very primitive and crude user interfaces to something that are a little bit more crazy. Now, I could have talked about brain-computer interfaces, about agents, about robots. I think there's still a lot of space to invent new forms of interaction. And I think, in general, it's not the case that the new form is completely going to erase the previous ones. And so what we have to think of is how these things work together, not just work in isolation. I don't know how many of you use voice-based interfaces. Yes. Now, would you do everything with Siri or Alexa? No, right? So it's useful in some situations, but there are some things that it will never be good at. So I think one of the challenges for the coming years is how are we going to integrate voice with virtual reality, with tangible stuff, with all these things, and not just invent new forms of interaction, but how they combine with each other. And with that, oh yes, I have this one. What future do you want? So, I talked about the computer in the loop versus the human in the loop. I think we strongly believe in computers as wheels for the mind, as tools to, augment our capabilities. When you look at Minority Report or Iron Man, it has this idea that it's making you more powerful in some meaning of power. But there's also this other future. This is from the movie Wall-E, where there's this small group of people who escaped Earth before it became unlivable, and they're on this spaceship called the Axon, where they sit in self-driving cars. They sip, soda all day long, and they watch probably videos on their screens that they didn't get to pick because they were selected for them. When you hear all this stuff around AI, I think it's trying to go in that direction sometimes. I don't know. I don't find this a very exciting future myself. So you are part of the people who can sort of decide and steer towards which direction we're going. So I'm going to leave it here. So do you have any question? I'm sorry, I didn't get to interact very much with you, but I was running short as usual. We're going to take a short break. Can we do 10 minutes? Yes? And then I will leave you in the hands of Wendy. Thank you.